The US presidential frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have increased their leads in the race for the nomination. Both scored resounding victories in the latest round of primary contests. The odds on Mr. Trump automatically qualifying for the nomination at the July Republican convention are getting shorter and shorter.
On the Republican side, it was a great night for Donald Trump. He had resounding wins in five states.
This one's a diverse victory. I mean, you go Rhode Island, and you go Maryland, and you go Connecticut, and you go Pennsylvania, and you go, I mean, the whole thing, Delaware, and every one of them was conclusive, and every state is so different.
It's looking more and more likely that Donald Trump is going to get the Republican nomination for President of the United States, despite the fact that many in the Republican hierarchy dislike him. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we revisit the story of Donald Trump and ask why it is that he's so popular with so many Americans. Donald Trump has portrayed himself as something of a self-made man, but his start in life was anything but humble. Gwenda Blair, author of Donald Trump, Master Apprentice, explains that Donald came from a family with a long history of entrepreneurs.
Grandpa came to the U.S. from Germany in 1885, which was the peak year of German immigration, and set out to kind of the last frontier, the last physical frontier, which was the Northwest, and ended up following the miners and the gold rush all the way to the Yukon, and got together a nest egg, came back to the East Coast. And his son, Fred Trump, that is to say Donald's father, made quite a bit of money in the middle of the 20th century on what you might call the next frontier, which was the New Deal. The whole post-World War I and then after World War II, giant federal government and its financing of mortgage guarantees for middle-income housing. So Dad made a lot of dough on that. And then along came Donald, who actually saw a different frontier, which was branding. And he launched himself in that and has been remarkably successful at really one of the early on people in celebrity branding.
So what kind of family did he grow up in?
There were five children. His parents were well-to-do. His father, by the time Donald was born in 1946, was quite successful. They lived in a 23-room house. They had a chauffeur and a maid. The kids were taken to their private schools in a limousine. So this was hardly a hard luck story. They were already very well-to-do. They were also a very close family. On Saturdays and Sundays, the dad would take the kids around to building projects, check on things, check on landlords and buildings, go up to the top floor by the back stairs and then come back down to see that the halls were swept. The kids went around picking up unused nails to be recycled. This was a guy who knew the value of a penny and didn't waste any.
If you go through the part of New York that tourists never want to go to, deepest, darkest Queens in Brooklyn, not the chic parts of Brooklyn, but the interior where you see these brick high-rise buildings or these brick, fairly charmless tract housing.
Editor-at-large of The Nation magazine, D.D. Guttenplan.
That's Trump Village and Trump City. Those were built by his father, Fred Trump, who was a quality builder who built homes for lower middle class people that they could afford, either apartments or houses. They were built on the cheap, and they were built in large numbers. And that's what made the fortune that made Trump possible.
One of the key influences on the Trump family was the writer and minister, Norman Vincent Peale, who was by then famous for his book, The Power of Positive Thinking.
Now, I have no objection to a person making money, provided they handle the money and the money doesn't handle them. And benevolence is a great thing. It's basic in the religion to give, and you can't give unless you've got it.
The family went to the Marble Collegiate Church in Manhattan, where Norman Vincent Peale was the pastor. And he, although not a household name now, in the mid-century United States, and even around the world, he definitely was. His book, The Power of Positive Thinking, was a huge bestseller. It sold 20 million copies, And its message is kind of a practical Christianity, that it's kind of God's plan for you to be successful. It's not just okay to be successful, you should be successful. And it was a very, very upbeat, everything is going to work out and just go for it, was his message. And Fred Trump was very taken with that, and the kids were very taken with that. And Donald's first marriage to Ivana was in the Marble Collegiate Church with Dr. Norman Vincent Peale at the altar.
Donald began his career in New York real estate with the backing of his father's money and his father's connections.
Well, there were several deals, but he had his father's very considerable resources at his disposal, not, of course, that he could cash them in, but that spoke to his credit worthiness, and he had his father's financial connections with banks and other with financial institutions, and he also had his father's political connections, and both of those things were very important and worth a great deal at pushing him to the head of the line. And he also was able to, as I said, tap into the fact that New York City really wanted some building to happen because it wasn't happening. And the first deal that he ended up doing was refurbishing a very dog-eared hotel right in the heart of downtown or midtown New York, right next to Grand Central Station. And Donald was able to get very favorable terms, a 40-year tax abatement, and a very, very favorable terms for doing that refurbishing. And he turned what had been a very classy but very old-fashioned place with a kind of limestone, traditional, laid-back look and demeanor into a very glitzy, fancy, shiny, marble, reflective surfaces, chandeliers all over the place, thing that was very different than what had happened before and really made his name.
Well, you have to understand that real estate is to New York what oil is to Texas. It's the source of wealth and the sort of local industry. It's like a one-industry town, and real estate is the industry. And in those days, the Democratic Party controlled all patronage and controlled City Hall because New York was basically a one-party town. And Fred was someone who was known as a benefactor to Democratic politicians. There was nothing corrupt or particularly egregious about the way Fred operated. He operated the way everybody else in the real estate industry operated, which is he bought tickets at Democratic banquets. He gave money to politicians when they asked him. But it meant that he was known to people and he knew people. And it meant that Donald knew people and also was able to hire this lawyer who was the son of the leader of the Brooklyn Democratic Party and who had many, many more connections than Donald had in those days. So he was able to open doors for him, and he basically made Trump possible as a Manhattan player. But Donald also displayed an incredible flair for marketing, particularly for marketing himself as a kind of brand. And then the other thing that's important to note about Trump is that as a real estate developer, he was never terribly successful. He would go way out on a limb. He would overextend himself in terms of leverage, and then the company would have to declare bankruptcy. Or later, when he had the casinos in Atlantic City, he would be bailed out because he had this huge ocean of cash coming through the casinos, and he could use some of that to cross-subsidize or to bail out his real estate operations. But Trump likes to portray himself as an incredibly successful businessman. He's been a successful casino operator. He hasn't been terribly successful as a real estate developer. There are very few of the buildings that have his name on them that he owns any piece of. And there's a reason for that.
You said about the branding, and I want to go back to sort of almost one of the most sort of magical pieces of branding, really, was the book that he wrote, The Art of the Deal, which was in 1987. So he was still a relatively young man. I mean, how significant was that? And how big a player was he even at the time in terms of New York real estate?
Well, he was not a huge player in terms of New York real estate, but he was a huge player in terms of the media. Donald Trump is crack cocaine to the press. You call him up, you feel bad about it, you know you shouldn't, but you do it, and then you get this incredible nugget of outrage or outrageousness that you can put on, and then you get response, and particularly in the kind of instant 24-hour news cycle age, there's no stopping him. I think it was a celebrity book like any celebrity book. I mean, do people believe that celebrity chefs are going to make your dinners better than anybody else's? Do people believe that celebrity athletes are going to teach you something that you can use? I mean, what they're going to do is they're going to let you into their celebrity. And that's, Donald Trump has always been willing to let other people into his celebrity. Now, of course, it's controlled and it's on his terms. And he's been brilliant at controlling it and keeping it on his terms. But I want to also point out something else about Trump, which is that he knows and was aware very early of how important his status as a celebrity is to maintaining his business and economic success. I mean, the selling the art of the deal was a good example of it, but a much better example of it were all of these buildings in New York where essentially investors from Japan or the Middle East would pay Trump millions just to have his name on buildings that he did not control the design of, he did not actually own. He was not going to be there, you know, if your toilet backs up, you're not going to be able to pick up the phone and call Donald Trump to come and unclog it. But nonetheless, having his name on their buildings was to these people worth paying a lot of money for. And so he was one of the really first people to figure out how to monetize celebrity.
The Art of the Deal came out in 1987. 3 years later, in the early 90s, Donald Trump was in financial trouble.
He had overextended himself by maybe as much as $1 billion. It's very hard, because so much of his stuff is privately held, in fact, everything, to ever be exactly sure about numbers. They're awfully squishy with him. But he was overextended by a very significant amount. But through branding, which I mentioned before, the frontier that he was so early on, he had made himself too big to fail. The financial institutions that he owed money to couldn't really afford to let him go under, because the things that they had invested in, that they had lined up to lend him money for, were not going to be worth as much if his name wasn't on them. And so they took a haircut. They lowered the rates of interest. They wrote some stuff off. And he emerged from near corporate bankruptcy. He is quick to say he never filed for personal bankruptcy. But during his four corporate bankruptcies, and the last one was 2009, he's been too big to fail. So he manages to get through these things, prepackaged bankruptcies, and emerges unscathed.
You're listening to Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're taking a look at Donald Trump and asking why he's so popular with a large section of the American electorate. When he announced he was going to run in the Republican presidential race in June, many people didn't take him seriously.
Whatever the size of his bank balance, Donald Trump says he will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created.
It's no joke. The egotistical business evangelist Donald Trump has applied for America's top job. Donald Trump announced his presidential bid in the Manhattan Tower named after him.
But within days of his announcement, he became the Republican frontrunner. Stefan Schmidt is professor of political science at Iowa State University.
It was a total surprise. Donald Trump has played with the idea of running for president before, but seemed to basically get bored and forget about it and walk away from it very quickly. How he managed this time around to plunge into this and then suddenly find himself rising in the polls, attracting larger and larger numbers of very enthusiastic people cheering him on, is something that will be studied very carefully by social scientists, especially political scientists, in the future, because it is a very surprising rise of an outsider.
He's someone who's really good at exploiting an opening. So in the past, it's not so much that he's run for office as he's allowed it to be known that he was thinking about running for office. And of course, he really is someone for whom all publicity is good publicity. In a sense, all of those other dalliances with running for office always seemed to me to be business moves, that his publicity would go up, his name value would go up, his recognition would go up, his celebrity would go up, and of course that would increase his net worth because he monetizes celebrity. I think this is a little different because I think what's surprised him, I think, as much as anybody else, is the response this time, that he's being taken seriously. And also, there's a difference between an opening and a vacuum. When Trump said he was thinking of running for office in previous occasions, there was an opening in the sense that maybe it was a slow week in the press. You know, maybe he could get a friendly reporter to write a couple of stories saying Donald Trump is thinking of running for governor, for mayor, for president. Doesn't really matter. What matters is the name Trump in the headlines. The difference is that there were other candidates then who were either more interesting than him as political candidates or at least able to keep the agenda away from him. The difference now is that the total void, even though there are 16 other Republican candidates, in terms of their impact on the news agenda and on public debate, it's nil. And so he's expanded to fill that, and he may have to actually run for president.
There has been a bit of a history of sort of celebrity candidates in US politics before. Does he fit into that, or do you think that in some ways he really is quite a unique phenomenon?
Celebrity, yes, but complete political novice, not so much. I mean, we tend to always say, well, you know, Ronald Reagan was a movie star and he became the top candidate and then won the presidency and, you know, served 8 years in the White House. But Ronald Reagan had already been governor of one of the largest and most prosperous states, which would be the sixth most richest states in the world, in California. So he had political experience, so it's quite unusual, especially for running for president, for someone who literally has not run for office or held any public office and has not been a major political figure in any other way to suddenly erupt, you know, onto the scene.
And I mean, what does that tell you? I suppose two things. One, does it tell you about the other candidates, the other sort of 16 candidates? And also, what does it tell you about the state of political debate that they are so interested in Trump at this point?
Well, I think it exposes the bankruptcy of our politics. I think there's no question about it. Look, America is a country like other countries, like your country, where we have a myth about ourselves and then we have the reality of how we live. And the myth in America is that we're a basically egalitarian society in which everybody has a shot and in which if you work hard and play by the rules, you will succeed. You may not become Donald Trump, but you'll at least be able to live in a home that you own and send your kids to school and your kids will have a better life than you. And there was a lot of truth in that myth for a very long time, but I think people don't believe it anymore, and they don't believe it because they can see it. They can see that Wall Street executives bankrupt the country and then the rest of us have to bail them out, and then they're back to it again. You know, their salaries are the same, their bonus pool is the same size, and meanwhile, people are still looking for jobs that haven't had jobs in 2 or 3 years. So I think there's a lot of anger. And I think that anger, first of all, I should say, I think a lot of that anger is justified. But I think what's interesting is that when you have a people very angry at the way they're governed, that creates a kind of potential for populist politics. In other words, for mobilizing that anger. And you have in Trump what I would call a kind of right-wing populism, and then you have in the Bernie Sanders campaign a left-wing populism. And they advocate different solutions. They target different people, you know. Sanders targets Wall Street and the financiers. Trump targets immigrants and people who are different. But in a sense, that's a difference in this between left and right in America. I think the sort of the success of Trump's campaign, to the extent that it succeeds, reveals something, frankly, ugly and frightening about my country. But that may be the reality.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Well, his policies actually are, let's call it a condensation and a kind of crystal clear, sharp position of what the other Republicans have been advocating.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words.
So when he talks about border security, which all the Republicans talk about, militarizing the Mexican border and so on, and building essentially the Great Wall of America, I would guess it would look somewhat like the Great Wall of China, with Donald Trump's portrait on several of the turrets. And so he has actually taken what have been clearly conservative and hard positions on many issues and hardened them even more, made them even more understandable for people who are concerned about things such as immigration. And that has resonated, I think, very strongly with a lot of people who think that all the other Republicans running basically would not really follow through and enact the policies that they're advocating. In other words, there's distrust in most of the other candidates on the part of this percentage of Americans that supports Donald Trump. So the answer to your question is that Trump's positions are actually more divisive. They're farther away from any compromise than the position of many other Republicans. And precisely that seems to be what is appealing to people.
Donald Trump can call himself a presidential candidate and continue to boast about the money he's made in business.
A total net worth of $8 billion. Net worth, not assets, not liability. A net worth after all debt, after all expenses, the greatest assets, Trump Tower, 1290 Avenue of the Americas, Bank of America building in San Francisco, 40 Wall Street, sometimes referred to as the Trump building.
Annabelle, the way it works is this. You don't really need money. What you need is media coverage, because the money that is given to candidates by political action committees, by wealthy people, or even just by individuals giving small amounts, is used to buy television, to buy publicity. And in part, it's used to build an organization. But the publicity is the most important part. Donald Trump, right now, today, as we speak, Annabelle, has gotten more publicity than any other candidate of the 17 who are running. And he hasn't paid a cent for it. Not one cent, because he hasn't run a single commercial. He has bought no television time. He has bought no radio time. He hasn't put advertisements in newspapers or other publications. It's all been free media. And that's because he is such a showman. He is like the circus that comes to town. He gets it all for free. And the news media themselves now are in a trap because they have to cover him. And the reason is they're getting huge ratings, viewership, by covering him.
Everyone wants to know if any of the other 16 Republican candidates will manage to get a word in edgewise above the soaring rhetoric of Donald Trump.
Governor Jeb Bush, businessman Donald Trump.
24 million Americans tuned in to watch this debate, and that's where many got their first taste of a would-be President Trump.
And that was certainly true of the first presidential debate, where the Americans were so fascinated with what would happen at that debate because Donald Trump was there, that it had the highest ratings, well, as high as large sporting events like the Super Bowl and others, I think. It was spectacular, and Fox News made a fortune because it had such huge viewership, therefore driving up their advertising costs. The next debate, which is coming up in a while here, is expected to have the same or even greater viewership because Donald Trump is there, and everyone is just hanging with bated breath to see what he will do next. And so by virtue of his personality, which is larger than life, he can certainly go a long, long way without taking money from anyone. And he can spend his own money on hiring some professionals here and there to actually organize. And I know several people here in Iowa who have worked for other campaigns and are working for him and are doing an excellent job, by the way. These are really, really good people. You don't need a lot of people. You need just a few people to do a superior job in identifying and then contacting potential participants in the process. So, yes, I think Trump can go quite a long way. And the interesting thing is that he's gotten large audiences in southern states, in New Hampshire, which is New England, which is very different from southern states, large audiences in Iowa and other places. So he seems to be able to gain this incredible visibility because of the local media, because the news media is so fascinated with him, without spending a cent.
Mr. Trump, One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
is only Rosie O'Donnell.
The crucial thing to bear in mind about Trump is that he will say anything. Listen, let me tell you a story. Back in the 1980s, I was a media columnist for a newspaper in New York that was called New York Newsday. There was another billionaire in New York who was trying to finance a documentary film company, and he thought that it would be interesting to do a documentary about Trump and where his money comes from. He owned a newspaper called The Village Voice, where I had worked for a while, and Trump didn't like it. He didn't like being put under the lens in this way, and so he wanted the guy to stop. Now, how do you put pressure on a billionaire? Well, what Trump did is he told people, he let it slip, that this man's wife had called him up and asked him out on a date, and that's why this guy was bankrolling this film, because his wife was angry because Trump had rejected her sexually. The press was like, on the one hand, we all felt dirty, and on the other hand, he said it. He's a public figure. We had to report it. And it just made me realize that he'll say anything. He's like, you know, in the movie The Usual Suspects, Kaiser Soze, and the idea is what makes him so terrifying as a figure, the Kevin Spacey character, is because he'll do anything. Well, that's Trump. He's the Kaiser Soze of politics. He'll say anything.
They have assets, $9,240,000,000. I'm not doing that to brag, because you know what? I don't have to brag. I don't have to, believe it or not. I'm doing that to say that that's the kind of thinking our country needs.
When I was interviewing him, and I must note that he was always very courteous to me, and when I talked to him, I was always kind of disappointed that I couldn't really get the answer to anything I asked him. I would have spent hours preparing lists of questions, and he was just not responsive. He didn't answer them. He didn't seem to have any interest in talking about the past and talking about what had shaped him. He had no rearview mirror. He was only going ahead. And it took me a long time to grasp that the content really didn't matter, that he just kept talking. And the way that he just kept talking, which I think people have seen in recent weeks during the debates and when he gives addresses, he just talks about himself. And at the end, he hasn't really answered anything, but you get this like ongoing, incredible rush of energy, of ego, of the ability to make everything be about him, that everything has been a success, that the world is lined up at his door, that he can do it. And it's kind of such a tsunami of Trumpness that you don't quite know what to make of it. And I finally grasped that that's who he is and what he represents.
Gwenda Blair. My other guests, Stefan Schmidt. And the editor-at-large of The Nation magazine, Don Guttenplan. Today's sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for joining us.
The world is most peaceful and most prosperous when America is strongest. America will continue and continue forever to play the role of peacemakers.